This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Sherman Indian High School's modern buildings sit in the middle of a residential neighborhood in Riverside. A Spanish colonial administration building is the only hint of its long past. This is a boarding school where Native American students from across the country can come and earn a high school diploma while also maintaining their tribal traditions and language. They also have a museum for the school's 100-year history.
So this is the reading room, and so we have like a little library here, and then we do keep some of the materials that we're working with.
Volunteer curator Amanda Wixon explains there were hundreds of these schools built on reservations and 25 federal off-reservation boarding schools.
There's only four left, and this is one of them, and we're the only one that has a dedicated museum and archive.
During the peak of the boarding school era in the 1920s, these schools were built to strip Native children of their culture. Many of them have closed and are viewed as sites of trauma, but Sherman is different. Students who once came here to lose their traditions are now, instead, learning to practice them.
To have all these activities going on in that space is like just, of course it's healing, right? Exercising a lot of demons, I think, there.
How did that transformation happen here, and why? Here's reporter Megan Jamerson.
A visit to the Sherman Indian Museum isn't complete without taking in the giant glass case of school trophies or the room full of artifacts like handwoven rugs and expertly crafted basketry. But the true treasures just might be the four generations of student stories waiting to be released from school documents.
So then this is the room mainly that the students work out of.
This well-organized room is bursting at the seams with history, explains Wixon, an enrolled Chickasaw and PhD student. Over 10,000 photos that were recently digitized are sitting in archival-grade containers. And then in a nearby narrow closet, shelves are packed with rosters, student bulletins, and yearbooks going back
all the way to 1892.
At the turn of the 20th century, these schools were built to, quote, kill the Indian and save the man by turning them into Christians and sources of labor. In the 1920s, over 80% of all school-age Native American children were in these schools. They were often taken by force away from their parents and communities. During these early years, children often experienced violence, mistreatment, and neglect.
Did trauma take place? Is it still happening in communities? Absolutely. But there are so many additional instances of resilience, of organizing, of putting pieces together.
This is Sam Torres of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. He says in order to have a complete picture,
we have to also be able to talk about how those policies were resisted against and where that brings us into this present moment.
Now, under the leadership of the first Native American Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, this history is getting wide attention outside of Native communities. This summer, she ordered an investigation into cemeteries at these boarding schools where students were often buried.
It seems like this is a moment where we can really put our hearts and our minds together and finally get folks to listen to what we've been saying for a long time. Because it's not that these stories haven't been shared. It's not that these narratives haven't been told. It's that they haven't been listened to.
The Sherman Indian Museum has been listening for decades and doing the work of telling a nuanced story of the boarding school experience. This mission is led by the museum's director, Lorraine Sisquak, who is the glue that keeps this place together.
So this was my community, and this was what I felt and what supported me in my younger years.
Sisquak grew up at Sherman in the 1960s. She went to public school but lived at Sherman because her grandmother was a teacher and her mother monitored the dorms. Sisquak, an enrolled Fort Sill Apache and a descendant of the Kaweah, says when she was growing up, her tribe in Oklahoma didn't have a reservation.
I wanted that for the community, for our students, for our urban community, for my own family and, you know, friends. So I think it worked out pretty good.
Today, Sherman is a place where students can learn their tribal languages and the traditional use of local plants. That's the result of efforts that started around the civil rights movement and the Red Power movement of the 1960s. Back then, alumni started returning to the school as employees, ready to reverse course on the school's early history of cultural genocide. It's also around the time that Howard Dallas got here. And for him, the boarding school experience wasn't traumatizing, but culturally affirming.
I can only say that I had the greatest experience of my life. And if I could do it over again, I would do it all over again.
When Dallas, an enrolled Hopi, first came to Sherman in 1966, he was 11 years old.
I was probably only like 5'2", maybe, probably about 120 pounds.
At the time, he didn't know why his mom sent him to Sherman. Much later, he learned that after his father's death, his grandparents, who also attended Sherman, encouraged Dallas's mom to send the oldest kids there rather than raise all 16 on her own.
My three sisters and myself, we were all put on a bus and we were sent to Riverside, California.
At the time, the school was called Sherman Institute, and it was still mostly a vocational school. Up until now, Dallas went to public schools with mostly white kids, so his first days at Sherman were also his first days around other Native kids.
And to be honest with you, this is going to sound kind of funny to you, I did not even know I was from the Hopi tribe.
He had to learn about his heritage in order to relate to the other students. This didn't come easy, and he remembers being called a white boy. But that didn't bother him.
It helped me to do more, to be outspoken, to be part of the student body.
First, Dallas joined the school band to play the snare drum, where the music teacher, Mr. Green, taught him about the value of hard work. Then his small size caught the eye of the cheerleaders, who made him an Indian Brave outfit to be the mascot for the basketball team.
Because we were called the Sherman Institute Braves.
And as a high school student, he became a member of the student council that led the effort to get the school accredited and the name changed to Sherman Indian High School.
You kind of put yourself in a position where you want to help other students understand that we can be a positive organization by helping make good changes for everyone.
And now any chance he gets to return to campus, he does, in order to remind himself of these stories, even if he's just passing through town.
I always make it a point to at least drive by and just wave. It was my childhood, my growing up period.
A huge part of what Lorene Sisquak does at the museum is collect the oral histories of alumni like Dallas. And listening to both the positive and negative stories is central to her work.
I can't push one way or the other. You know, it's just their story.
Having the school and museum open is one thing, but it's getting former students and Native leaders to visit that really makes this a community, says Amanda Wixon.
That is the healing that's done. I mean, we can put all these things in place and do archival programs, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really like all the Native community that keeps coming back and just even their presence.
And through their presence, they show how the school that was once forced on Native Americans has become a place for cultural affirmation and healing. For KCRW in Riverside, I'm Megan Jamerson.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and just like that, Omicron has come to America, and specifically California. The CDC confirmed today that a patient who'd arrived from South Africa has the newly mutated COVID strain, as tested by UC San Francisco. Health officials and city leaders here in LA are keeping a close eye on it, with the holidays here and, of course, a lot of traveling going on. Barbara Ferrer is director of LA's Department of Public Health, and she's here to talk about it. Welcome back, Barbara.
Thanks for having me, Steve, and good day to everyone.
Yeah, I mean, Omicron, this variant, could it already be in L.A.?
I think highly likely. If I were to guess, I would anticipate that sometime in the next couple of days, and we should anticipate that.
So how concerned are you from a public health perspective about this? This one has more spike proteins. They can attach more to, at a molecular or a cellular level, right?
I mean, what we're really worried about with this variant of concern is the number, the sheer number of mutations, which again, then when you've developed, for example, a vaccine or some therapeutic medicines to a virus that looked very different, a strain of this virus that looked very different, if you've got these modifications, and as you noted, some of those mutations are, about 30 of them were in the spike protein, it could affect the way our vaccines would be able to work. It could affect the way our medicines and our treatments are going to work. But that's information we just don't have yet. And the truth of the matter is about the vaccines that we're using here in the United States, so far, they've done exceptionally well against, you know, four different variants that have cropped up. So we can feel hopeful that with the vaccines we're using in this country, those approved vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, we're still going to get decent protection even against a new variant. But since we don't know that for sure right now, we're going to also rely on some of the other tools in our toolkit. You know, that masking that everyone hates at this point, we're so exhausted with it, well, that masking becomes a super important layer of protection.
Well, it was the only layer of protection, that and social distancing and closing a bunch of things, right? At the beginning, when there were no vaccines, when we didn't know what was going on.
Exactly. And I'm so glad you're bringing that up, Steve, because, you know, the other reason to be hopeful is we are in a better, we are in much better shape. I mean, not only do we have vaccines, but we have rapid testing. And we have more testing. I mean, we all remember the disaster of you know, the spring of 2020. We couldn't get people tested. We didn't even know who was infected. We don't have that problem anymore. And as a matter of fact, you know, this would be a time to remind people that testing is an important tool. If you've had exposures, if you've got some symptoms, if you've done some travel, particularly internationally, go ahead and get tested. Because it will allow you to be able to find out very rapidly whether or not you may be asymptomatic but still carrying the virus and capable of infecting others. We've also got some treatments, and you know that we weren't there last year.
I am not a big fan of the what if game, but here's the what if, right? Which is, what if the vaccines don't perform as effectively, you know, against Omicron, or even the therapeutics by Merck and Pfizer and these others that, that are coming out. Do you see any more local health order changes? You know, do we shut things down again? I mean, is that something that's in the, you know, in the toolbox?
You know, I want to start with, you know, the other tools that are in the toolbox that we're going to go to immediately. You know, we're going to go to the masking. We're going to go to a lot of testing, particularly for those most vulnerable. We're going to insist that people actually isolate and quarantine appropriately. We're going to be particularly careful to make sure at our healthcare institutions, our skilled nursing facilities, places where people experiencing homeless are staying, that we're taking care of those who are most vulnerable. We're going to do a lot of extra messaging about reducing risks if you're a person already at higher risk for serious illness should you get COVID. We're going to encourage our businesses to look at their spacing, you know, and do ensure that there's as much distancing as possible. And I'd like to do all of that and see how well we can do in the worst possible situations before we start looking, you know, at, you know, sort of the stay-at-home scenarios. We never want to say to everybody, you know, oh, there's no way we're going back there. Because, you know, none of us really can, at this point, predict the future.
No, nobody wants to hear that, by the way, right? Nobody wants
right.
to hear that.
Right. Well, and nobody wants to do that anymore either. The good news is we got a lot of other tools, and we're going to use all of them to try to prevent, you know, that most drastic measure. And I think, again, you know, the spirit of cooperation, the spirit of people taking care of each other, that got us through some very hard times before, and I think it can again. I don't want to say, it's, you know, there's never a scenario where we have to go back home. You've seen, obviously, in other countries where they've just had such a big surge that they've been, you know, really in some ways, you know, forced to go back to these more drastic measures. But we're doing much better here in California, and my hope is that we continue to do much better.
And the tools that are being used right now, I mean, we're talking about vaccine mandates for, indoor restaurants and gyms and bars and sports venues, things like that. LA County has similar things in the toolbox, right? How difficult are those vaccine mandates to enforce?
Well, we're seeing pretty high compliance right now. Certainly, as our inspectors are out and about, I think, the honest truth is, 81-82% of residents 12 and older in LA County are vaccinated. So the vast majority of people get it. They got vaccinated and they like the protections that those vaccines offer. And they're much happier to be able to go to a movie theater where everybody around you is also fully vaccinated. I think we've had really high compliance because most people are in fact vaccinated at this point. I think it's also, upon us constantly to be out and about in our communities, providing good information, answering people's questions, so they too can feel as confident as the rest of us do in getting vaccinated and making sure access remains easy. So none of that's going away.
We're going to need to wrap it up, but I want to ask you before you go, the numbers seem to be trending downward. I see fewer and fewer people who are testing positive, but the test positivity rate seems to be going up. Hospitalizations are down. It seems like a mixed message. How are you guys feeling right now?
Well, I think, we need to sort of understand that there was some changes that happened the week of Thanksgiving. Around testing. So, we average about 100,000 tests a day right now in LA County that happen across our school districts. Schools were closed last week as our volume of testing picks up because our schools are back to doing that routine testing. I think you'll see both the number of cases, go back to where they were, and you'll see test positivity go back down. Hospitalizations, they're averaging now about 560 a day, staying relatively stable. As long as our case numbers, remain sort of over 1,000 a day, we're going to continue to have hospitalizations, and we're going to continue, tragically, to have people die every day.
Barbara Ferrer, Director of LA's Department of Public Health. Barbara, as always, thanks for coming on, talking to us.
No, thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, the COVID numbers may be down here in greater LA, albeit slightly. Healthcare workers are burned out, stressed, depressed, not just because of the pandemic, by the way, but a report by the United Nurses Association of California and the Union of Healthcare Professionals says nurses were physically and mentally fried far before COVID-19 took over, and the pandemic has only made things worse. Many healthcare workers, especially nurses, are leaving the profession. Some are finding much higher paying work as traveling nurses. And all of that is causing problems for many hospitals, especially in California, which, according to the report, is facing the greatest nursing shortage in all of the 50 states. Erin McIntosh is a rapid response nurse at Riverside Community Hospital and a local union steward of SEIU 121. She's back with us today. Hey, Erin.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's nice for you to join us again. Clifford Daniels is the Senior VP and Chief Strategy Officer over at Methodist Hospital in Arcadia. Cliff, welcome to you.
Hey, thank you, Steve. Happy to be here.
Erin, I want to start with you. So just the first question, the obvious one, how bad is it?
Well, these problems started long before the pandemic. The pandemic just exacerbated them. And many nurses have gone months and months, even up to a year, without breaks and lunches. And we're all feeling the short staff. And I think the worst part is that it's affecting patients.
As a union steward that covers, you cover more than 24 hospitals. When did you see this shortage starting to really make a broad impact?
The shortage has been going on for a long time. It's kind of like this cycle that happens where we're continuously short-staffed, nurses pick up extra to kind of pull the slack, then they get burnt out and they leave the profession, which leaves us short-staffed again. This happened before the pandemic, but after the pandemic, I feel that it's gotten much worse because of all the post-traumatic stress in dealing with all the death and dying from COVID.
Clifford, how are things over at Methodist? Are y'all struggling to keep enough nurses working through the shifts there?
The simple answer to your question is yes. As is happening nationally, but particularly here in California, you know, vacancies are growing and hiring is slowing. You know, we're seeing, you know, certainly an insufficient number of new grads, but we're also seeing shortages as a result of defections to other states, as you alluded to, states where there are higher and continued surges of COVID patients are luring California licensed nurses away with, you know, exorbitant offers of $8,000 to $10,000 per week plus housing to be travelers. So that shortage here has truly been bad, and it's exacerbated in key areas like critical care and surgery and labor and delivery.
What about the vaccine mandate, Clifford? Are you seeing nurses leave because they don't want to get vaccinated?
No, I would tell you that at Methodist, I believe the most recent numbers, we have 98%. You know, you always hear about there's, you know, oh my gosh, there's 5-10 people who aren't vaccinated. We have 98%, I believe, of our workforce, including nurses, that are fully vaccinated. So that's not really been the issue. I would tell you, you know, the issue is these nurses who, to Aaron's point, are really burned out as a result of the pandemic and are retiring early or leaving nursing early. You know, the second thing is that there are nurses that are still struggling with finding daycare, particularly for toddlers. And then, you know, the people that are still at home taking care of ailing parents or spouses are also not back full force in the full time into the workforce.
Aaron, you mentioned that the understaffing and mental burnout is taking a big toll on patient care. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, what does that look like at in Riverside?
Well, to talk a little bit about, you know, we kind of fill staffing positions with travelers. I know that 40% of my colleagues have left for, like he said, higher paying jobs traveling, or they've retired early, or they've left for childcare issues, or they just burn out from nursing altogether. And what ends up happening is they fill those positions with travelers who honestly are in it for the money. And maybe not all of them, but a large majority of them. If you don't have nurses that are from the area, like I work at a community hospital, and so I'm very invested in my community. And I take care of my patients like they're my neighbors, they're my friends, they're my family. Somebody that comes from maybe, you know, outside of the state that's only here temporarily, they're maybe not as invested in patient care. And you can kind of see that.
Have you been tempted to take a higher paying job, a concierge nurse or a traveling nurse?
Every day I go to work, it's stressful. Nurses are out of ratio, and ratio meaning the safe amount of patients that any nurse is supposed to take care of. And every day we go to work knowing that you're not going to get a break. There's been times where I go to work and for the full 12 hours, I realize at the end of the day that I haven't drank any water, I haven't peed. But I still continue to have hope. So have I looked? Maybe slightly, but I feel like this is my community. These are my neighbors. I feel like they deserve better. They deserve a nurse that's well-rested, a hospital that's well adequately staffed so that we can provide good care. I imagine that when I'm sick, I'm going to end up at the hospital where I work.
Yeah. Clifford, what happens next from your perspective? I mean, are there any potential solutions that you've come up with from an administrative perspective?
We are trying in many new and innovative ways to recruit full-time nurses to work at the hospital. Certainly the optimal employee is someone who lives in the community and works full-time in the hospital. But that said, you know, the travelers that we need to resort to adequately staff the hospitals are certainly qualified. So we don't see the diminishment of quality necessarily when you have travelers. What you have is though you have constant turnover and you know the unreliability of knowing where the next after 3 months are we going to replace them with another traveler, or are we going to be able to hire a full-time nurse that'll be here for years? So that's a challenge, and what we're doing now from Methodist perspective is looking at new and innovative financial incentives for nurses with respect to things like offers for loan repayment or relocation assistance, things of that nature, particularly with the cost of living here in Southern California. looking at areas where we didn't look to recruit nurses before. So winter's upon us, and looking in cold weather cities, you know, saying, hey, it's 75 degrees in Southern California today. How do you like that weather that 0 degrees and snow in Chicago? Wouldn't you rather come work here? So it's not so much a quality issue with respect to the use of travelers, but travelers are a lot more expensive to the hospital. Registry is a lot more expensive to the hospital than having a full-time nurse as well. So like I said, right now the shortage is as bad as it has ever been. I've been doing this for 35 years, and hopefully it'll, as the pandemic begins to mitigate, the shortage will as well. And we'll see nurses coming home from working out of state. And, you know, to Aaron's point, more nurses coming back into the fold that have not been in the workforce for a while for those reasons we talked about earlier.
Clifford Daniels, Senior VP and Chief Strategy Officer over Methodist Hospital of Southern California. Aaron McIntosh, Rapid Response Nurse at Riverside Community Hospital and local union steward over at SEIU 121. Thank you so much to you both for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Been a pleasure.
That'll do it for us today. Tomorrow, how the crisis of LA's unhoused is playing at City Hall. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast there and tell us how you're doing. Tell us how we're doing. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Crystal Goss, Vincent Nguyen, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Bill Richards, Amy Toss, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all help piece this evening's show together. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.